have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. I am Rob West. Jesus' instruction to his disciples in John 16:33 is a strong reminder that we live in a fallen world. As followers of Christ, we too will experience hard times, but the Bible tells us how to overcome them. We're off today, so please hold your phone calls. This is MoneyWise on American Family Radio, biblical wisdom for your financial journey. Living in a land of religious freedom, we don't experience the type of tribulation that followers of Christ experienced through the centuries, at least not yet. We also are the wealthiest country in history, and often Satan doesn't attack our weaknesses, but our strengths. When we rely on ourselves, then, our strengths become our weaknesses. If money is your stronghold, you become vulnerable. We don't know what the economy will do in the months and years ahead. That uncertainty is especially strong right now, and it's causing a lot of fear. Folks are worried about their investments, inflation, gas prices, even their jobs. But to say we don't know the future is only partially true. We may not know about tomorrow, but we certainly know that as a disciple of Christ, our ultimate future is secure. With the gift of grace through faith, we'll one day be with Him for eternity, joyous and safe from all tribulation. In the meantime, we must endure. More on that in a minute. Just know that God hasn't left us on our own, even though it may sometimes feel that way. In times like these, it's important to remember three things about the God we serve. First, no matter what happens in this world, God is always in control. Not a single molecule moves outside of His divine will. Isaiah 40:28 reads, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable." Second, as the creator of the universe, God rightly owns everything, including us. We are only His stewards of what He gives us. We own nothing. Psalm 50, verse 10 and 11 reminds us, "For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. I know all the birds of the hills, and all that moves in the field is mine." Taking this to heart should help us to not cling to our money and possessions, but rather cling to God. And third, God knows your needs. In fact, He determines them, again, according to His will. Knowing your needs, God has promised to fulfill them, and He always keeps His promises. Psalm 37:25 reads, "I have been young and now am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread." Of course, as we often tell you, it's critical not to confuse needs with wants. God will sometimes provide your wants, but He will always provide your needs. Matthew 6:25 and 26 reminds us, "Do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they?" All this should be of great comfort when we're fearful about losing the things of this world, especially our money. God is all-powerful. He owns everything, and He will never forsake us, regardless of what's happening on Wall Street. It also means that any tribulation we experience is the will of God. If that sounds harsh, it's not. God always has a purpose, and His purpose is always for our benefit. Romans 5, 3, and 4 tells us we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And James 1, 2, and 4, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." God has given us everything we need to know about stewarding His resources. The Bible contains more than 2,300 verses on money and possessions. When we follow His financial principles, we don't have to worry about what tomorrow will bring. God is in control. Any hardships we face are only His way of building our character and conforming our will to His, that we will become more like Christ. 2 Peter 3:18 reads, "Grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. To Him be the glory now and to the day of eternity." What may seem harsh now will have eternal benefit because God is always acting in our best interest. Well, I hope this leaves you with hope for the future, not fear. We'll be right back. To have you with us today on MoneyWise on American Family Radio. This is where we apply God's wisdom to your financial decisions and choices. What are you thinking about financially today? How can you process that decision through the lens of Scripture as we apply the counsel of God's Word to your financial decisions and choices? The themes that we see in Scripture that we're to live by holding what God has entrusted to us loosely, by accepting our role as steward or manager, by not allowing the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches to choke out the word in our lives, to live with contentment and have generosity be a theme or a hallmark of our life. As we put all of that together and then seek the Lord for His guidance for us individually, we can then make decisions about lifestyle and saving and giving and all of it. But we want to do that together here in community each day on MoneyWise. And by the way, if you'd like to receive our weekly digest email of the latest trending financial topics from a biblical perspective, well, just head to our website, moneywise.org, and click the button that says Create Your Free Account to subscribe. Again, moneywise.org, and click Create Your Free Account. All right, to the phones we go. Chicago, Jim, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Hi, thanks, Rob. You know, I have four children, and three of them are making pretty good money over the summer. They've been caddying. They've have several thousand dollars that they've wound up, you know, saving, and they don't need that money right away, but they don't need that money in super long term either. Is there a good short term, you know, 3-year type investment thing that'll be better than your normal savings account, but good for them?
Yeah. So you did say the time horizon on this is 3 years or less?
Yes, probably in that range. Maybe a little bit longer for one of the younger ones, maybe 3 to 5 years. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, if we're less than 5 years, typically would say we're not really investing this money just because we would want to be so conservative that it probably doesn't make sense. There is kind of a unique opportunity right now for you that I think, you know, normally is not present because of the liquidity beyond a year and because of the safety, and that is I-bonds, these inflation bonds we've been talking about quite a bit about. Have you heard us describing these?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So they're inflation protected series I bonds issued by the U.S. Treasury. I standing for inflation, it has a fixed component, which is near zero, but the variable component, which adjusts every 6 months, is pegged to the consumer price index. And you can purchase these I bonds in a child's name, and you can buy up to $10,000 per person per year. And it would be, you know, subject to federal income taxes in most cases, but not state or local taxes. And you've got almost, you know, no risk because these are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. So you would go to the website treasurydirect.gov, and then to buy in a kid's name, you would need their full name and Social Security. You'd create the account on the Treasury Direct website and log in, and then you would actually make the purchase, and then you'd deliver the bonds through what's called the gift box to that person's Treasury Direct account. And they've got to be held for at least 12 months. But after 12 months, you can pull them out at any time. If you do it in less than 5 years, you would just give up as a penalty 3 months worth of interest. But given the safety and the phenomenal return, I think this would be an unusual time to take some of this money, get a good return on it, and, you know, still be able to get back to it and have it fully liquid after 12 months. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds great. So what did you say the website was at first? Sorry.
Yeah, it's treasurydirect.com. Treasury.gov. That's the U.S. Treasury's website where you buy electronic bonds, and it's pretty self-explanatory. Just click on the Series I bonds, I for inflation, and you'll open the account, and it'll actually walk you through all of the process, including the process to purchase these for kids, okay?
All right. Thanks so much.
All right, Jim. God bless you, my friend. Carrie's in Missouri. Carrie, you go right ahead.
Hello. I'd like to ask about home we inherited that is paid off in Florida, repairs, and we would like to take out an equity loan in order to do those repairs. Our home in Missouri is still, we owe $30,000 on it, and I'm not sure what would be the better move to make, taking equity out on the one we're living in currently or the one in Florida.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you certainly could look at both. Did you say the one in Florida is free and clear?
Yes.
Yeah. You're likely going to get a little better rate on your domicile, your primary residence. But I like the idea of you using a home equity loan with a fixed interest rate as opposed to a home equity line of credit, which has a variable rate. As rates continue to head up, that home equity line of credit would increase. But as long as you know how much you want, you can take that loan out for the exact amount you want, you know, and at closing, and then use that for the purpose of, for which it's intended. I'd prefer you to get it on that home in Florida, just so we can keep all of that there, and you can work toward getting your primary residence free and clear. But at the end of the day, with you having such a small first mortgage on your primary residence, I could go either way. I think it's really going to come down to where you can get the best rate, and that's probably going to be on your primary residence. I would get at least three bids, Carrie, for that home equity loan. Try to find the one with the lowest fees, the best rate and terms. You can use bankrate.com to do that search. You could certainly check with your local bank as well, but I'd get at least two online lenders into the mix as well. Does that make sense?
It does. Can I ask you one more short thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
We had thought about getting enough to pay off our Missouri if we borrow on the Florida home that's paid off. Would that be wise, or do we need to just leave that?
Probably not. Tell me about the mortgage that you have remaining on the Missouri home. How many years left? What's the interest rate?
Well, I have it paid off in about 3 years, and the interest rate is 2 point something. So it's
low. Oh boy.
Low.
Yeah, no, don't touch that. Because a couple of things are going to happen. Okay. Number one is the cost of that home equity loan is going to be contingent upon the amount you're borrowing. So if you buy more or you borrow more, then the fees you're going to pay on that are going to be higher. It's typically a percentage of the amount you're borrowing, number one. And number two, you'd be replacing that low interest rate mortgage that's going to be paid off at 3 years at 2.5% with something quite a bit higher, you know, north of 5.5% probably. So that, you know, doesn't make any sense. So I'd stay on your current track to pay that off in 3 years, keep that low interest rate intact, and then figure out which home to put that second home equity or the second mortgage, the home equity loan, if it's the primary residence, you know, on your existing domicile.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. You are welcome, Carrie. Thanks for your call today. Back to Chicago we go. Rich, thank you for calling, sir. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I had a cable bill that I disputed with the cable company a couple of years ago, and I thought we had it all settled. And lo and behold, I get a letter from a collection agency saying that we owe $37 on a bill from 2+ years ago. My question is this going to affect my credit score, which is about 810 or 815, or should I just not worry about it?
You know, I would try to get it cleared up because although, you know, your utilities, including your cable bills, typically is not reported to your credit report, when you get to a situation where you have a collection that is unpaid, it can be reported to the credit report. But because it's only $37, you may prefer just to go ahead and pay it and be done with it. So that's going to be up to you at the end of the day, kind of how you want to handle it. Thanks for your call, Rich, and we'll be right back. Thanks for joining us today on MoneyWise on American Family Radio. I'm Rob West, your host. So glad you're along with us today. Hey, are you a part of the MoneyWise community? Do you count on this broadcast? Have you been on our website? Maybe you use the MoneyWise app or you've taken advantage of one of the coaches. Whatever it might be, we would invite you to be a financial supporter of the ministry. We're listener-supported as a not-for-profit ministry, and we do what we do every day as a result of your generous support. And if you'd consider a gift, we'd certainly be grateful. Just head to our website, moneywise.org, click the Give button. That's moneywise.org, and click Give. You can be a monthly patron or a one-time giver. You'll find all the ways to give there online, and thanks in advance. All right, back to the phones we go. Brandon, Florida. Nikki, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Hi, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Hi.
I am calling because I am having to learn to start saving all over again from ground zero. I opened up two different kind of certificates through my bank, but they're like short term, like for 6 months and then for like a year. But I have like four credit cards, two through Capital One, one through Navy Federal, and one through Merrick Bank, and they're over $5,000. But I don't make enough money. So how can I be able to start bringing that down, even though I'm only paying the minimum? What can I do to try to, you know, help myself out? It's just so much.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that question. You know, Nikki, so many people listening today can resonate with where you're at. Whether it's regretting decisions we've made in the past with finances or just wanting to be more on top of things, wishing we were out of debt and the flexibility that comes with being unencumbered. And yet, what I would tell you is that you can absolutely make that commitment today to say, I want to move forward in a way that allows me to be a faithful steward of what God has entrusted to me. And so we have to first recognize that God owns it all and we're his money managers. That's an important shift in our thinking because it really colors everything we do. If I realize I'm the money manager of God's resources, then it causes me to make different decisions at the end of the day. And we realize then that money becomes not an end, but a means to an end, really a tool to accomplish God's purposes in your life, which includes enjoying what you have and providing for your family, but also aligned with your values, saving for goals and giving generously, all of the things that I know you would love to be able to do. But it's frustrating when we feel like that financial foundation is not there. And so the question is, how do we move forward in a way that allows you to do that? And that's really always going to come down to, once we recognize God owns it all, the spending plan. And so you really are going to need to take the time to get an accurate accounting of what it takes to operate your household on a monthly basis. And that needs to include not only the things you get a bill for, but the non-recurring expenses, those things that come up maybe semi-annually or annually, like an insurance payment or Christmas. And then also the discretionary spending, those things that you spend, you know, perhaps out and about, whether it's clothing or a coffee shop or entertainment, you know, those things that our money finds its way into. And once you have all of that, then we've got to do the hard work of making the decision of where we're going to cut back, because the key for you is margin. That is, after the bills are paid, something left over that allows you to pursue your God-given goals and objectives. Now, specifically with the credit cards, and we can actually kill two birds with one stone here after I tell you my solution on the credit cards, because the budget will come with it. With the credit cards, we recommend what's called debt management, which is not debt consolidation, where you'd take out a new loan to pay off the other loans. And it's not debt settlement, where you let them get, you know, delinquent and charged off and creditors and collectors are calling, and then you try to negotiate a lower payoff. Debt management is a program that's already in place using a credit counseling agency. In this case, we recommend Christian Credit Counselors, and they leverage programs that are already in place with each of the creditors to get the interest rates reduced dramatically. And as a result of one level monthly payment that'll fit into your budget and those lower interest rates, you should be able to pay this debt off 80% faster. I think the key, though, is that it happens month after month, so it's not a quick fix. But that's a good thing because we want to get that built into your budget. And then I want you to do the hard work to figure out where else you can cut back so that you have some margin to build up your emergency fund and make sure you're giving and, you know, saving for the future, maybe contributing to a retirement plan, something like that. But debt management, I think, is going to be the key, Nikki, to you actually making some progress with every payment to bringing these credit cards down because of the reasons that I mentioned. But let me stop there and see what thoughts or questions you have.
So what was that again? It was Christian Counseling?
Yeah, so it's ChristianCreditCounselors.org. They've worked with thousands of our MoneyWise listeners. You'll call them or connect with them over the internet on their website. They'll set up a time to meet with you over the phone. They'll look at all of your credit cards, tell you exactly what the new interest rates would be with those particular creditors that you have, help you put together a spending plan, and then you'll set up one monthly payment that you'll pay through them to your creditors, and with these lower interest rates, get this paid off much quicker. And I think that will give you the momentum, perhaps, that you've been looking for to feel like, okay, I'm actually making some progress here, and now let me go back to work on my budget, make some changes over there. And it may feel like a whole new day for you in terms of getting out of the discouragement and getting into really a hopeful situation where you can see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Thank you so much. I do have one more quick question.
I've got just a minute before my next break. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir. So for the, if you're in a relationship and you know some of the final things are finances, could break up a marriage along with a whole bunch of other stuff, but how do you go into the next step of trying to get into a marriage when you know one person is making all this money and the next one's not? You know, how can we merge that together?
Yeah, prior to marriage, is that your question?
Yes.
Yeah, so like during the process of premarital counseling and so forth. Yeah, let's talk about that because that's a great question. So I'll take a quick break. You stay right there. We'll talk about money and marriage just around the corner, plus a testimony from Betty and much more. Stay with us. All the lines are full with some great questions. So you sit back and enjoy as we mine the scriptures and apply God's wisdom to your financial decisions. Thrilled to have you along today on MoneyWise on American Family Radio, biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. I'm Rob West. All the lines are full, so let's go right back to the phones. Nikki is in Brandon, and Nikki, just before the break, you asked a follow-up question about money and marriage, specifically how you bring together, preparing for marriage, the finances from two people, perhaps quite different in terms of the assets that they've accumulated and so forth. But that's the gist of it, right? This is kind of in a premarital situation.
That is correct. We both have been together for 7 years, but he makes over $75,000, almost $80,000. I don't have, you know, I don't make that much. I only bring in like $38,000. Yeah. So we want to have a discussion about finances before we even get to that step. So both of us have been divorced. Now we want to get married again, and we want to do things the right way.
Yeah, so, yeah. I'm glad that you're thinking about that, Nikki. That's so important. Are there kids involved here?
Well, none between us other than I have my own. Okay. My youngest is 17. My oldest is 24. He has a 24, and he has a 15-year-old. So it's not like we're bringing, you know, a bunch of children in right now.
Yeah, sure.
But I will only be bringing in my 17-year-old to be staying with me, you know, once we get to that level. But we're talking about it like soon, maybe next year. But I want to make sure, you know, things are lined up financially, you know, like how much you got saved. And that's always a question. How much you got saved? Now I'm like, oh, my gosh, I hate that question.
Yeah. Well, a couple of thoughts, I think. Number one is communication is key. I know you all have been together for 7 years, but perhaps you haven't had some of these conversations about handling money in your new marriage, because when two become one, that includes finances. So I think you all need to have some very intentional discussions around, number one, what is our lifestyle going to look like? What is his definition of your lifestyle moving forward? What is yours? How was money handled growing up? How are you all wired? Is one a spender and one a saver? It's not that one's right or wrong. We just need to recognize how God has wired each of you. Who's going to be the bookkeeper, even though you're going to have shared financial goals? And what are some of those goals in terms of giving and saving for the future and those types of things? So having all of those conversations are really key, because it's not a matter of, well, I make this and he makes this and we have separate accounts. That's going to foster not God's design for marriage, which is oneness. You know, we need to have, I think, in my view, one account. It really doesn't matter who makes what, whether he's making more than you now, because it may change down the road. But it's really the resources that God has provided to you as one flesh, as a married couple. Then the question is, how are we going to handle what God has provided to us or entrusted to us as stewards of that money, regardless of the conduit with which he provides it, whether it comes through you or comes through him? The key is togetherness with regard to your planning and your decisions moving forward. I think there's also another dimension here where you have kids from prior marriages, where you've got to think about, is there any aspect of this with assets that are being brought to the marriage prior to you all marrying, from your former spouses, where you'd want to separate those and give them directly to your respective kids. I think that's perfectly appropriate, as long as it's done in a way that's productive and with open and honest communication, where all those decisions are made in advance. I want to direct you to a couple of resources that I think will help with this. Number one is a website called Family Life Blended. .com, Family Life Blended. This is kind of a derivative of the Family Life Ministries, but it's specifically resources for blended families from our good friend Ron Deal. And he'll help with some of these things in terms of financial planning, even something called a togetherness agreement specifically for couples marrying that have been married previously with kids. So I want you to check that out. I'm also going to send you a book called Money and Marriage God's Way from Howard Dayton, and I think that'll help. I'd love to challenge you, for you and your future husband, to read through this book a chapter at a time and talk about it. And I think that will really set the stage for you all to do this in a God-honoring way. Okay, Nikki?
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome. You stay on the line. We'll get your information and get that right out to you. Betty in Crawfordsville, Indiana, thank you for calling. I understand you have a testimony. Go right ahead.
Well, I don't know what questions to ask is my problem. Some of my problems. My husband and I have been married for 58 years. He was the bookkeeper. He was the brains of the outfit, and I was the laborer. Which is okay, because I love what I do. The problem is, every spouse should not let the spouse do all of that, even though we agreed. Because here I'm stuck with running a business, and sometimes I just don't know what to do. And playing around with the Indiana taxes, you know, I've been in deep trouble with, you know, they haven't closed me down. Every time they send me something that says I owe this, I send it right out to them. And but the big part that I'm so thankful for is for this radio station and the fact that God has seen me through. I have been able to pay the bill. I have had food on my table. And, you know, I don't have a lot of problems that a lot of people have. But
yes.
I really concentrate on God, and, you know, every day it's show me the way. I got to figure this all out.
Wow.
And it has happened.
A couple of thoughts, Betty. You know what? First of all, I'm so appreciative of your testimony of the faithfulness of the Lord in your life and the testimony to your husband and how he handled what God entrusted to you all as a married couple. And I would concur with you that so often we get so reliant on one spouse who's perhaps more inclined toward financial things. The other spouse is then left not knowing where things are, what assets are there, and just how to keep the family running. It could be something as simple as a credit card that's only in their name, that when the one spouse passes away, all the cards go away, and there's a temporary time where they don't know how to pay the bills, not to mention, you know, who are the financial professionals involved, where are the assets, and then what decisions need to be made moving forward. So that really is key to be able to work together on that so that that awareness is there. I think for you, Betty, a couple of things. Number one is I think it would be great to have a financial advisor, a godly financial advisor walking alongside you that could be a source of wise counsel for you as you navigate what God has entrusted to you, the assets that you have, the monthly spending you have, the taxes, the insurance, just a trusted resource there that you can meet with a couple of times a year and that could really be that sound board, and to the extent you need investment management, actually managing those assets for you. We recommend certified Kingdom advisors. These are men and women who've met high standards and training and competence in providing biblical financial advice with pastor references and client references and character requirements and code of ethics. It's our trusted designation for godly financial wisdom. And you could find several CKAs in your area at moneywise.org and then interview two or three. I would also direct you to a great website from Miriam Neff and Valerie Neff Hogan called widowconnection.com, specifically for widows in your situation, and in particular dealing with the financial side, although they deal with a lot of other aspects to this. Widowconnection.com, they have some great resources and books. Miriam Neff and late wife of the Robert Neff, Bob Neff from Moody Bible Institute, and she has a wonderful ministry serving ladies just like you. I'd love for you to check it out. Thank you for sharing your story today, and we'll be right back with more Money Wise on American Family Radio. We're delighted you're spending some time with us here at MoneyWise on American Family Radio, where we apply God's wisdom to your financial decisions. Let's head back to the phones. Grand Rapids, Michigan. Cora, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm not sure if I'm in a pickle or not. Anyway, I am 75 years old, and what happened, I bought a car like 4 years ago, and I went and got $25,000 that I borrowed.
Yeah.
And now it's up to, like, the interest is up to 6.14%, and I owe $28,000 and $28,269. And so I don't know if I can go back and try to get the interest rate down, but then I have to pay. I guess I do a refinance or something. I don't know, but that's what I did a couple of times.
Yeah, and let me ask you just to clarify a couple of things. Did you say the interest rate is 6 or 14%?
No, 6.14%.
Oh, 6.14. Okay, got it. And why is the balance growing? Have you had late payments? Was there penalties? What's going on there?
No, it's just growing because I'm not paying extra on it.
Yeah, but with a car loan, if that's what this is, there should be an amount going to interest, but also an amount going to principal. And the balance should be declining, not increasing if you're making your payments.
It's not a car loan. It was just the money that I borrowed. I bought some other things, you know, at that time. But it wasn't a car loan. It was just a money. It was just a loan. It was
from
just a
who?
Loan from the bank,
okay.
Huntington Bank.
Got it. All right. Well, you need to call them and find out why the balance is increasing. Because if you've been making your payments on time, the balance should not be going up. It should be going down. So you need to understand, they need to give you an audit, if you will, of the payment history and show you where the money that you're sending is going and why it's not enough to cover the interest on the account. Because obviously they're saying essentially that what you're paying each month is only a portion of the interest. And so the rest of it, the balance is increasing. Well, that's a recipe for disaster because you'll never pay it off. At the same time you do that, you also need to begin exploring, Cora, looking at refinancing this, and I would look at refinancing it with a car loan. What is the age of the car?
Well, the car is dead now. I had an accident. I had someone hit me. I'll express myself. So the car is gone. I had another car accident again, so I don't have a car, period, right now.
I see. All right. So, yeah, this is tough. Well, we need to look at what you have right now with the National Bank or Huntington Bank, and find out how you get this going in the right direction. See if they can re-amortize it, or, you know, you can increase the payment, because right now it's increasing. And we got to figure out why. And then beyond that, I think we need to look at perhaps getting another loan of some kind that could be. I mean, the interest rate isn't terrible. We've just got to refactor the loan so that there's a payment that you can afford, but where it's actually reducing the balance every month. So I want you to get some more information and then reach out to one of our MoneyWise coaches. In fact, if you just hold the line, we'll have one of our coaches call you, and they can help you process and understand the information you get from Huntington Bank, and perhaps give you some counsel on where you go from here. But we need a bit more information before we can do that. So hold the line. We'll get your contact information, and I'll have one of our coaches contact you to help you with this. And Cora, we appreciate your call today. To Windham, Ohio, Bob, go right ahead, sir.
Yes, I turned 70 a couple months ago, and so I have started to need to receive Social Security. And I am still working, and I expect I'll work for another 10 years before I retire. And I'm wondering, do you have some recommendations on what I should do with the money that I get from the Social Security until I need it in 10 years?
Yeah. How much are we talking about? How much have you built up that you could put to work, and how much you receive in a month?
Well, I have $100,000 from the sale of a house a year ago, and I have been adding to that at the rate of $500 a month, and so I expect that I'm going to start putting an additional $1,500 away a month.
Okay. And how much do you want to keep liquid?
I have a 6 months emergency fund, so...
In addition to the $100,000?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So it sounds like you could put that to work. I'd probably connect with an advisor, Bob, who could really help you think about, you know, what is your time horizon on this? How conservative do you want to be with an investing strategy? But 10 years is plenty of time for you to say, let's, you know, take a little bit of risk and see if we can grow this money over the next decade. Since you don't need it, you're adding to it, and you've got plenty of emergency reserves on the side. So I'd reach out to a certified Kingdom advisor there in Ohio and see if you can interview two or three, find the one that's the best fit, and put together an investment plan or strategy that makes sense. I mean, the other approach, if you wanted to do it yourself, would be to say, you know, maybe we do a 70-30 portfolio or 60-40 of bonds to stocks. And you could use indexes, you know, a total market index fund and a total bond index fund. But with those allocations I talked about, where you're fairly conservative, and the goal is over the next 10 years just to grow this very inexpensively. If you wanted to do it yourself, you could take that approach. Otherwise, I'd prefer, especially in a market like we're in right now, that, you know, is on the heels of a, you know, long bull market. We could be in a sideways market here for a while. It's really a time to have an active money manager. And I think somebody who could build that portfolio for you with your goals and objectives in mind and deploy this money in a thoughtful way that's disciplined and rules-based over the next 10 years makes a lot of sense. So if either one would be fine. If you want an advisor, you just head to our website, moneywise.org, and click Find a CKA. Bob, we appreciate your call. Christine in Florida, go right ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like some advice on how to know when to sell the house. I've already retired. My husband has two more years. We have a fully paid for home waiting for us in North Carolina, and we're excited to go there, but we can't go until he retires. Right now, we're in Central Florida that has got crazy building going on. It's very, very fast, you know, as far as the real estate is concerned, but we've got this big fear, and so our prices is listed as really high when you go to Zillow. But our fear is that over the next 2 years, it's going to go into a recession and the housing market's going to fall apart. And then when we go to sell our house, you know, we're getting substantially less. But, you know, if we sell it now, it would help quite a bit. And then just try and rent in town. But the rentals are higher than our mortgage is. And just the whole double move. So how do we make that decision? I mean, we're willing if we actually have to go ahead and put the house up to sale now and try and find a place to live, scale down, and get ready for the move to North Carolina.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's no way to know for sure. I mean, I can tell you absolutely the housing market is cooling after being on a massive tear over the last, several number of years. And that's driven largely by a slowing in the economy and interest rates rising. But the things you have going for you, Christine, are A, we still have a housing shortage in this country because of the folks now working remotely. The millennials are now of age where they're having kids and buying single family homes. And you have an added benefit is that Florida is a huge destination right now because of high taxes in other states. You're seeing a massive inflow there. Plus, they're not making any more waterfront real estate. So you're in a strong position there. You know, they say location, location, location. So I think from that standpoint, you're going to weather even a cooling in the housing market in Florida, perhaps better than other parts of the country. Even if we saw a recession, most economists think at this point, it'll be a mild one, at least in the near term, the next couple of years, like you're talking about. At the end of the day, could we be wrong and the housing market begins to, you know, have a pretty significant pullback? It's possible, but I think for the reasons I mentioned, Florida and just the lack of inventory of homes, I'd be comfortable if you guys really want to avoid the double move, you guys staying and, you know, selling it when you're ready to go. But if you just really feel like, man, we're not being good stewards if we don't lock this in, and you're willing to make the double move, you can certainly make a strong case that, you know, it's at its peak right now, and it's only going to cool from here. The question is, are we just going to move from a red-hot buyer's market to more of a seller's market, but prices level off, or are they actually going to fall? If they fall, I think it's going to be minimal, but, at the end of the day, nobody knows. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I see. Okay, all right. Well, I appreciate your input on that.
All right, you're welcome, Christine. Thanks for calling today. Folks, we've covered a lot of ground today, some really great calls. You know, as we wrap up, let me just share a couple of thoughts on this topic of how and when to help the needy. You know, poverty and need are facts of life in a fallen world. I mean, Jesus clearly said that in Matthew 26, the poor you will always have with you. Some poverty, of course, is self-inflicted. We read in Proverbs, the sins of laziness, stinginess, love of pleasure, greed, gluttony, and drunkenness can all lead to economic poverty. Sometimes, though, people can become poor through no fault of their own. Now, generosity towards those in need, no matter how they got that way, should be a hallmark of Christian living. I mean, the Bible clearly says that. God expects us to be generous givers, but we're also supposed to be good stewards. So how do we balance that? How and when do we help the needy? Well, I think a couple of thoughts on that. One is the Lord is absolutely concerned about the poor, so we should always be ready to help those truly in need. Psalm 82 says, defend the cause of the weak and the fatherless, maintain the rights of the poor and oppressed. On the flip side, Proverbs 21 says, if a man shuts his ear to the cry of the poor, he too will cry out and not be answered. So we should defend the rights of the poor, but we should also include the poor in our financial giving. Proverbs says that as well. So I would say, you know, if God prompts you to give, no matter the situation, listen to his voice. We are to give generously, sacrificially, willingly, and cheerfully to meet the needs of the less fortunate. And when we meet physical needs, there's opportunities to fill spiritual needs as well. You think about that. Thank you to Pat Montague, Robert Sutherland, and Devin Patrick. Couldn't do it without them. Thank you for being here as well. Come back and join us tomorrow. We'll be here to do it all over again, Lord willing. Bye-bye.